I'd like to welcome everyone here this evening to this talk titled Understanding Reality and Its Integration in Daily Life. So some of the points that we're going to be going through in this session are, I'm going to begin by giving a very brief introduction into the view of reality from a Buddhist perspective. We're going to look at why is it important to understand and realize the nature of reality. And we're going to have a brief look at how to explore the nature of reality, particularly by focusing on consciousness itself. And then we're going to practice a very short meditation based on that exploration, how to explore reality by looking at our own mind. And then we're going to look at how we can integrate these insights into our daily life. And then there'll be time for some questions at the end of the session. So I think we've got about an hour and a half, 2 hours. So let's begin. Okay. So what is the nature of reality or the view of reality from a Buddhist perspective? Within Buddhism, there are a number of different philosophical systems. And of course, they have their own assertion about what is the nature of reality. There are two philosophical systems called Vaibhashika Sautrantika, who basically say that there is an objective world out there, and this objective world is made up of very subtle particles. So they're more or less sort of classical physics approach. There is an objective world there that can be measured. There is another philosophical system called Chittamatra in Buddhism that rejects this idea that, in fact, they say there is no external world whatsoever. There appears to be a material world there, but if we look very closely, we'll come to realize that the world is internal to the mind. And they use the analogy of a dream to back up their assertions. Because in a dream, there also appears to be a material world in the dream. But if we become lucid in the dream, we will really directly realize that these appearances are deceiving us. So they say, likewise, if we closely investigate the nature of reality, even though there appears to be a material world external to us, we'll realize that this is an illusion, that the world is actually internal to the mind. So their assertion is there is no material world whatsoever. This is an illusion. It's internal to the mind. There is another philosophical system, the one we're going to be looking at this evening, called Majjhimika, or middle way, and they say there is an external world there, but that external world is not existing independent of the observer, that there is a dependent world, that, in fact, their assertion is that nothing exists independently, and this is the idea what's called in Sanskrit shunyata, or usually translated into English as emptiness, that everything is in the nature of emptiness, that nothing exists independently. There is no independent me here. There's no independent objective world out there. So that's what we're going to briefly introduce now. So therefore, if nothing exists independently, therefore, things exist dependently. So if we can understand what they mean by things existing dependently, we can better understand the view of emptiness or shunyata. So let's have a look at what the Majjhimikas say about how things exist dependently. So they say that everything is a dependent arising. Arising here means coming into existence. So how do things exist dependently? We can talk about that in three ways. That things exist depending on causes and conditions. For example, this laptop here exists depending on causes and conditions. One of the original conditions necessary, of course, someone needed to think about designing this laptop. And then, of course, all the raw materials are necessary. They needed to be refined. The various components needed to be manufactured. All of those components needed to be assembled. plus all the factories and people and everything else involved in the process. All of these conditions were necessary for us to have a laptop here today. That's straightforward, I think. I think we can sort of appreciate that. Also, of course, everything exists depending on its parts. This laptop, without the casing, the screen, the keyboard, the electronic components, the battery, without all of these parts, there would be no laptop. So laptop exists depending on its parts. But remember here, what we're saying is that the fact that everything is a dependent arising should be overturning our idea that it exists independently. But I think most of us here are quite happy to accept that this laptop exists depending on causes and conditions, and it exists depending on its parts. Yet, at the same time, I think most of us here are quite happy to accept that when we walk into this room, there's already a laptop existing here on the table. True or not?
True, yeah.
That shouldn't be possible, according to this reasoning. Yeah. It's either existing dependently or independently. But these ideas don't seem to be overturning our idea that when we walk in the room, there's already a laptop existing here independently. Why? Because we don't understand these ideas. We only understand them at a very superficial level. To understand these ideas at a deeper level, we have to go to the third way in which things are dependent. That things exist depending on imputation, labeling, conception. These are three different words for the same thing. So if you understand one of those words, then you understand all three. So when we see this, we think, I know what that means. There's a thing on the table that I'm calling a laptop. Again, this is fairly superficial understanding. To understand this at a deeper level, what we can appreciate is that when we look out on the world, what are we receiving is a mass of sense data, particularly visual data. And then we have to make sense or meaning out of all of this data. So what do we do? What we do is we draw lines around various collections of data and create meaningful objects. If we didn't do that, we couldn't function. It would just be a mass of colour and shape. We wouldn't be able to function. So we draw a line, create a meaningful object. But then, of course, we do more than that because we live in this world with others. So to be able to communicate with others, we have to give names to the things we created so we can communicate. This is what this means. This is the process of drawing lines, creating objects, and then giving the name. How we divide up the world is not fixed. It's completely arbitrary, depending on the meaning that we want to get out of what we experience. For example, how many objects are there? How many things are there? Most of the time, for us, it would be meaningful to draw one line around all of that data and create one object and call it a star. But in other situations, it may be more meaningful to draw two lines and say there's two triangles there. Or another occasion, we can draw six lines and say there's six triangles. Or seven lines, saying there's six triangles and a hexagon. Or we could say there's simply a collection of 18 lines there. So how many objects are there? Is it 1, 2, 6, 7, or 18? How many objects are there? We decide. There is no star existing there from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework. We bring the star into existence by drawing a line and creating one object and calling it a star. Therefore, what we say in this philosophy, this Majjhimaka philosophy, is there is no star to be found there in the basis, because a star only exists within our conceptual framework. So what we find is a couple of terms. That things are not findable, meaning you cannot find a star there from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework. And things are merely labelled, meaning things only exist within our conceptual framework. So again, there's no star to be found there in the basis, independent of our conceptual framework. We create the star. This is what this means. So based on that, let's go back now and have a look at these two ideas and see if we can understand them at a deeper level. So this is a timeline, this is a seed, and this is a sprout that it's producing. So the sprout or the plant exists depending on causes and conditions. The underlying cause is the seed. Conditions are the soil, sunlight, water, and so forth. So we need the seed and all of those conditions to produce the plant. And we believe these exist independently of our conceptual framework. If that's true, then it should be a fixed, obvious point at where the seed becomes the plant. So who can tell me at what point does the seed become the plant in this process? At what point? And when we look at this question, what we can appreciate, the point at where the seed becomes the plant, we decide. When this configuration of data stops looking like our concept of seed and starts looking like our concept of plant, that's the point. And we all have slightly different concepts of seed and plant. For some of us, this is already a plant. For some of us, it's here. For some of us, it's here. We decide when the plant comes into existence. So the plant only exists within our conceptual framework, as does the seed. Here's another question to think about. If two things are in a cause and effect relationship, by definition, they cannot exist simultaneously. Correct?
Yes.
Good. The seed and the plant are in a cause and effect relationship. The question is, think about it, does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? So think about it. Does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? Can only be two answers, yes or no. Which is it? Yes or no? Does the seed stop existing before the plant comes into existence? If we say no, that means they're simultaneous. By definition, this is impossible. So no is illogical. Cannot be. If we say yes, the seed has ceased to exist, where is the plant coming from? Yes is also illogical. So both no and yes are illogical. Therefore, our common sense idea of cause and result, based on our assumption that things exist independently, is completely illogical. It cannot work. So what the problem is, of course, is our underlying assumption that things exist independently. And actually, the founder of this Majjhimaka philosophical system, Nagarjuna from the 2nd century, great Indian master, has his classic text on this called Mula Majjhimaka Karika, where he has 27 chapters of these arguments. He says, you believe in independent existence? What about cause and result? How does that work? How does agent and action work? How does fire and fuel work? All of these common sense ideas become illogical based on the assumption that things exist independently. So these are very powerful arguments to cut the false view that things exist independently. Another point here. We say that the result, or the plant, depends on the seed. In other words, the result depends on the cause. But this view is also saying that the cause depends on the result. How does the cause depend on the result if it precedes it? The answer is, of course, you can't call something a cause without the idea result. You can't call something a seed without the idea plant. Whether or not it produces it, irrelevant. So you can only have cause if you have result. Let's look at parts. Pen exists depending on its parts. But is there a pen to be found here anywhere? Can you find a pen here in the basis, independent of our conceptual framework? Is this a pen? No. Is this a pen? No. Is this a pen? No. Is the plastic piece on the end a pen? No. Is the tube a pen? No. Is the ink inside a pen? No. Is the round ball on the end a pen? No. Where's the pen? People are, oh, that's easy. It's the collection of all of that. There's the collection. Oh, no. In a certain shape. You have to tell me when the pen comes into existence. No one yet? No? No takers yet?
No.
So again, when does the pen come into existence? Only when this configuration of data closely enough resembles our concept of pen. And our concepts usually have at least two parts, appearance and functionality. So when this appears closely enough to our concept of pen, and it seems to function according to our concept of pen, then there's a pen, not otherwise. We bring the pen into existence. So again, the pen exists depending on its parts, or in other words, the whole depends on the parts. But this view is also saying the part depends on the whole. How does the part depend on the whole? Again, the same idea. You can only call this part of a pen if you have the idea pen. Otherwise, it's nonsensical. Whether or not the pen exists is irrelevant. You can only have part of a pen if you have the idea pen. So the part depends on the whole as well. And this is a measure of our understanding of this, or the flip side, the idea of emptiness, is if we can appreciate these two statements are not saying the same thing. And the two statements are, usually we say this is a pen, or in other words, the pen is the collection of the parts. But this view is saying that's false, that the pen is merely labelled depending on the collection of the parts. So again, the two statements are the pen is the collection of the parts versus the pen is merely labelled depending on the collection of the parts. If we can understand those two statements are not saying the same thing, we're beginning to understand something about this idea of emptiness or shunyata. Because if the pen did exist from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework, it would mean everyone who looked here would see a pen. So if a caveman came in the door here, they'd see pen and they'd start writing with it. I don't think so. If a caveman came in there, they may see some sort of weapon, stabbing, to stab things with. And if a dog came in here, they may see some sort of chewing stick. And if a tiny ant came here, they may see some home to live in. So is this a pen, a weapon, a chewing stick, or a home? From its own side, none of those things. From the side of the observer, all of those things. We bring things into existence in our conceptual framework. Things do not exist independent of that. Now, with this view, and the flip side of dependent arising, of course, is this idea of emptiness. In Sanskrit, shunyata, again, emptiness means nothing exists independently because everything is dependently existent. Now, the difficulty with this view here, and this is the view that's the basis of this Majjhimika philosophical system that really began with Nagarjuna in the second century, great Indian master, is that we are stuck in what's called the two extremes. We are stuck in the two extremes of existence and non-existence. For us, we're stuck here now, meaning we believe that everything exists from its own side, everything exists independently. There's an independent me here, there's an independent objective world there. But if we investigate and we come to realize that there's nothing to be found there, then often what happens is we simply flip to the other extreme, non-existence or nihilism. Because for us now, there's only two possibilities. Either there is this real, independent, functioning world, or there's no world. Because the only world that we've experienced is this seemingly independent world there. And if we start to undermine that through this investigation, then we just flip to the other extreme and go, oh, I can't find the laptop there in the basis, therefore there's no laptop at all. It doesn't exist. I don't exist. Nothing exists. So we flip to the extreme of nihilism. Because for us, there seems to be just two possibilities. But again, this philosophical system in Sanskrit, Majjhimika, middle way, is to find the middle way between those two extremes, that there is a third possibility. And the third possibility is that things are merely labelled. There is a dependent world, there's a dependent me. And this is why I think so many of us in our modern world struggle with this view. Because in our modern world, we're all in the intellectual mind. We want to figure out everything. But actually, what we can understand from this, it's our intellectual dualistic mind that created the problem. And so, like I think Einstein said, you can't solve a problem at the level you created it at. So you will never get an answer to this question of what is the nature of reality using our intellectual conceptual mind, because that is the problem. It's our dualistic thinking that is the problem. So you can't find an answer within that dualistic thinking. All we're going to do is we're going to flip from one extreme to another, because that's the only two possibilities within our dualistic thinking. So if we want to find out what the nature of reality is, we need to go beyond this dualistic mind. And even if we somehow intellectually appreciate this idea, and we can be the smartest philosopher in the world with this, we can still be completely miserable. Because the Buddhist assertion is that if we come to realize the nature of reality, we'll be liberated from all mental afflictions and suffering. Because the Buddhist assertion is the reason we have mental afflictions like anger, jealousy, craving, and so forth is because of our distorted view of reality, because of grasping onto independent me, independent world. That leads to our mental afflictions and suffering. And if we want to overcome that, we need to gain a correct view of reality. But intellectual is not enough. For example, we all, I think, intellectually accept things are changing moment by moment, the idea of impermanence. Science has conclusively proven that everything is changing moment by moment. We learned that at school. I think all of us intellectually accept this fact. None of us have a problem with this. But is that intellectual understanding of impermanence, is that helping us in our life? Not really, because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. Our behavior is driven by our instinctive habits. And our instinctive habits are telling us this laptop is more or less the same laptop that was here yesterday. It'll be the same laptop tomorrow. And that's how we relate to things, as if they're actually stable and enduring. But this is completely out of sync with reality, because there is nothing stable and enduring in the physical world level. In fact, if we look very closely at the physical world, in fact, if we don't look closely at the physical world, there appears to be things moving through time. If we look closely, is there anything moving through time in the physical world? Anything? No. No, is there? There's nothing at the physical world level which goes through time. Nothing. There is just momentary change. There's just a flow of change. We know that intellectually. Yet, experientially, that's not how we relate to the world. We relate to the world as if there are things moving through time. With that, of course, come certain expectations, which, of course, are never met because there is no things moving through time. There is just a flow of change. And in that flow of change, we have to make sense of that flow of change. So we develop concepts like impermanence to help explain, and we create objects out of that flow to help understand the flow. But the problem is we don't realize that's what we're doing. We don't realize we are creating this world of objects based on the flow. We turn these lines that we draw into boundaries. We create boundaries, meaning we turn these objects that we create into separate, discrete things, as if they exist there independently and independent of us. Of course, this is completely out of sync with reality. And when we relate to things in that way, we're completely out of sync with reality. And therefore, we are fighting against reality. And if we fight against reality, we create mental afflictions, we suffer, and the people around us suffer. So what's the solution is to come to realize how things exist. But again, we need to realize this directly, not just intellectual, because intellectual is not enough, because our habits are very ingrained. We need a very strong antidote to that. We need to internalize these intellectual ideas. We need to meditate. We need to come to realize this in meditation directly. Then that will have a very, very strong impact on our mind. And thereby, outside of meditation, we will start to experientially see things as simply being a flow, as simply existing within our conceptual framework. And then we will overcome our mental afflictions and suffering. So very briefly, why is it a problem to see the world as existing there independently and as made up of many separate discrete things? What's the big deal with that? What's the problem there? The problem is that if we believe that there is a world existing independent of us, then when we have, for example, a pleasant experience, let's say I'm looking at this laptop and I'm having a pleasant experience, then that pleasant experience, together with the belief that that laptop is existing independent of me, will lead me to naturally assume there must be some attractive quality there that's causing my pleasant experience. So I'm going to see this as inherently attractive. Or if I'm having an unpleasant experience, together with the belief that that laptop is independent of me, I'm naturally going to assume there must be some unattractive quality there causing my unpleasant experience. Now, let's say we're having a pleasant experience when we're seeing this laptop, and we're believing that it's inherently attractive. There's some attractive quality there that's causing my pleasant experience. I like pleasant experiences. I want pleasant experiences. That laptop seems to be causing my pleasant experience. I want that laptop. Attachment, craving. Or if I'm having an unpleasant experience, I don't like unpleasant experiences, I don't want unpleasant experiences, that laptop seems to be causing my unpleasant experience, get it out of here, aversion. So if we have this false view of reality, then what happens is we end up with craving and attachment to our pleasant experiences, aversion to our unpleasant experiences, and then the whole mess begins. If we realize emptiness, if we realize that laptop is not existing independent of us, it's simply existing within our conceptual framework, and then we have a pleasant experience when we see the laptop, then experientially we are going to see that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And we hear that expression often. Intellectually, we may accept that now. We may accept that beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Is that helping us in our life? No. But if we can experientially see things that is beauty in the eye of the beholder, then what's to crave? What's to have a craving and attachment to? Which means if we have a pleasant experience and we've realized emptiness, we're not going to have any craving and attachment for that experience. Plus, we're going to enjoy that experience much more than we do now, because it's our craving and attachment which interferes with our enjoyment of pleasurable experiences. And we know this well. If we have strong craving and attachment for something, that agitates the mind. And if we don't get it, we get frustrated. Even if we get it, we get worried about not getting enough of it or losing it. And then when we do lose it, we get upset and crave more. So craving and attachment actually interferes and destroys our pleasure of simple pleasures. If we can realize emptiness and realize directly that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, we are going to enjoy pleasurable experiences much more than we do now. And conversely, with unpleasant experiences, and we have aversion to that unpleasant experience, our aversion, if we have particularly strong aversion, all that that does is it magnifies the discomfort and suffering we experience. So again, if we realize emptiness and we see an unpleasant experience, we will not magnify the suffering we experience. And very often the most of the suffering we experience is because of our aversion. So we're going to enjoy simple pleasures in life much more, and we're not going to induce suffering if we realize emptiness. But this, of course, is a very simple level. Now, how do we go about... one analogy before we go on to how we do the practice, and then we'll have a short meditation. This view of emptiness is very subtle, very difficult to appreciate. And again, most often when people start to investigate this, we just flip to the other extreme of nihilism. And I hear that a lot. You know, even people who've studied this for some years and think they know what emptiness means, often I hear people saying, you know, oh, it doesn't matter because everything's empty. I mean, that's completely the wrong understanding. That's nihilism. The correct understanding is because everything's empty, everything matters. Everything can function. That's the correct understanding of emptiness. So emptiness and functioning world or dependent arising are two sides of a coin. If we appreciate that, we have the correct view. Nagarjuna would be very happy with us if we had that idea. In fact, there are a number of modern-day philosophers, very smart people, who read Nagarjuna's work and say he's a nihilist. Very smart people. So this view is not easy to appreciate. And again, to really understand it, well, we have to internalize it. Because again, if we want to figure it out intellectually and conceptually, we'll never get the answer. Because the answer, the middle way, is non-dual, non-dual experience. So if we investigate this in meditation and we come to realize the nature of reality, if we come to realize emptiness in meditation and we come out of that experience and someone says, oh, tell me what you saw. What's the nature of reality? You'd go, it was sort of like this, sort of like that. You would not be able to explain it because emptiness means no subject-object duality. And, of course, our conceptual mind is stuck in dualistic mode. So, therefore, the answer is that there is no subject-object duality. There's no independent me, independent world. And to appreciate this view of emptiness, often a number of analogies are used in the text. And one analogy that I find very helpful is the analogy of a dream. Now, when we're dreaming, there appears to be a dream me here, and there appears to be an independent dream world out there. And if we see something pleasant in the dream, we react with a craving. Unpleasant, aversion, maybe fear, anxiety, we see a monster in the dream and so forth. But if in the middle of the dream we suddenly realize we're dreaming, so what we call lucid dreaming, of course, we wake up in the middle of the dream and we realize that we're dreaming, then there will still appear to be an independent dream me here. There'll still appear to be an independent dream world there. But now because we're lucid in the dream, we'll realize that these appearances are deceiving us. And we'll never buy into those appearances. Which means now if we're lucid in the dream and something pleasant or unpleasant occurs in the dream, it would become very difficult to react with attachment or aversion. And we would enjoy the dream a hell of a lot more. This view of emptiness is saying our waking world is like a dream. Because now there appears to be an independent me here. There appears to be an independent world out there. If we see something pleasant, we react with craving and attachment. Unpleasant, aversion, the big mess starts. But if we become lucid in the waking state by realizing emptiness, there will still appear to be an independent me here. There'll still appear to be an independent world there, but because we're lucid now, because we've realized emptiness, we will realize directly that these appearances are deceiving us and we'll never buy into them, which means we would become very difficult to develop craving and attachment for the pleasant experiences, develop aversion for the unpleasant experiences, and we would enjoy our life a hell of a lot more. So this is an analogy I find very helpful to understand the idea of emptiness and dependent arising. What I'd like to do now, as we're starting to run short on time a little bit, is to explore the nature of reality by focusing on mind or consciousness itself. When we investigate the nature of reality, we can investigate anything. We can investigate the pen, the laptop, the body, the person. In fact, the classical approach in many Buddhist traditions is when we come to investigate how things exist, start with me, the person. Where is this independent me that seems to be here? That's a very classical approach. And we use very logical reasoning to investigate to see if we can find this independent me here. But what I'd like to do now is to do a little bit of an experiment, a little bit of investigation, looking at the mind. So before we do that, just briefly, what is the mind from a Buddhist perspective? And a very simple definition of mind in Buddhism we often see, and of course here mind and consciousness are synonymous. Those two terms are synonymous here. Mind or consciousness is that which is clear and knowing, or sometimes translated as clarity and awareness. The word clear here . The first word in the definition is describing the entity of the thing itself. And the second word is describing the function. What does this thing do? For example, the simple definition of fire is hot and burning. So what's the entity of fire? Is heat. What does fire do? It burns. So here, mind is clear and knowing. What's the entity of the mind or consciousness? It's clear or has clarity. What does the mind do? It knows, it is aware. So the word clear or clarity here implies two things, at least. One is the mind is not the brain. So the Buddhist theory of mind, of course, is not the same as the scientific materialistic theory of mind, which basically is that the mind is the brain, or a property of the brain, emergent property of the brain, or a function of the brain. So here in Buddhism, mind is not the brain, it's not an emergent property of the brain, and the mind is not physical. So clear clarity means it's not physical, it's not energy, it's not matter. So within the Buddhist theory, there are two types of phenomena. There is material phenomena, matter and energy, and mental phenomena, the mind. And here, when we're talking about then, of course, the mind and the brain, we're not talking about a sort of a dualistic view. We're talking here, and this is something actually very interesting. I was watching today a video on YouTube from a professor of cognitive science from University of California, Donald Hoffman, and he is doing a lot of work in this area about the nature of reality for many years, and now his sort of working assumption, and of course, mostly in the scientific community, the basis is that matter or material is primary, and that somehow mind is some sort of epiphenomenon or emergent property of that. That's the assumption they're working with. But through his many years of scientific study, he's now come to the point where his working hypothesis is that the material world is not primary, consciousness is primary. And he's working on that basis, and he's now working on a mathematical formula or basis for consciousness, a mathematical model of consciousness. And now he's trying to show, using that mathematical model of consciousness, how things like quantum mechanics can come out of that. So very interesting research he's doing. So if you get a chance to watch any of this, I highly recommend it. Donald Hoffman is his name. So here, again, in Buddhism, consciousness is primary. It's not the brain. It's not a property of the brain. Of course, they are closely related. And the function of the mind is that it knows, it is aware. Of course, this is a huge topic, but I just wanted to briefly mention that before we jump into a little practice. So what I'd like to do now is a little sort of taste of investigating nature of reality by observing our own mind. So we're going to do a little meditation now. And one thing I'd like to mention before we do this meditation is that, of course, as a true scientist, we are to do empirical investigation. We are to observe directly the phenomena in front of us and not allow our intellectual beliefs to pollute that if we're really being empirical study. So What we don't want to do in this investigation is allow the intellectual mind to come in, because intellectual mind is full of belief systems, and that would contaminate the empirical investigation. Because if we allow the intellectual mind to come into this investigation, our intellectual mind, of course, always has an answer, because we have some sort of belief system in who we think we are and how things exist. And so if we allow our intellectual mind to come into this investigation, it'll say, I know, the mind is this, or the mind is that, or whatever our belief system is. Then we haven't done any empirical research. All we've done is we've agreed with our belief system. So we want to be scientists here. We want to do an empirical investigation. So therefore, when we do this practice, we're going to look directly in our direct observation. What is there? How is it there? Okay, so just keep that in mind. So let's do a short meditation and see what we see and see what we can come up with as our investigation. So let's do that shortly, and then a few more things to say after that, after the meditation, about how to integrate, and then plenty of time for question answer then. But let's do the meditation first. So just find a nice, comfortable posture. Sit comfortably. Keep your back straight and just relax the body. So simply allow your awareness to descend into your body. And simply become aware of sensations throughout the body. And if you notice any areas of tightness or tension in any part of the body, then use the out-breath to relax and release that tightness or tension as best you can. And then bring your awareness to the area of your face and soften and relax all the muscles in the face. Keeping the mouth and jaw soft and relaxed. And all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. In this way, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply allowing it to flow naturally and effortlessly. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment by focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body, wherever you can most easily notice any sensations associated with the breathing. Now narrow your focus and focus on the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen. So focusing on the sensations of the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. So, of course, we're using our mind to focus on the breath in the area of the abdomen. But where is this mind located? So, using your direct observation, see if you can pinpoint the location of the mind. Is the mind inside the body somewhere? Is the mind located inside the head? Again, observe directly. Is the mind located at the place where the sensations of the breath are occurring? Does the mind have a center, a central point? Does the mind have any physical characteristics whatsoever? Again, observe directly. How big is the mind? Does it have a particular size? Is in fact there a physical limit or boundary to the mind? Is there in fact anything outside of the mind? And now simply let go of all investigation and allow the mind to come to rest. And simply rest in the stillness of the mind. And then we can bring this meditation to a close. Just one comment, and then maybe actually we can do some question answer, because there was a few other things I wanted to talk about, but maybe I think it's good to do some Q&A now. But one point before I open up for question answer, with that investigation, maybe some of you didn't find it so easy to investigate. And of course, the reason generally is because we're using the mind to investigate the mind here. But our mind as a tool of investigation is not very functional now. So just like a scientist, if they want to run an experiment, they need to have equipment that functions well. Otherwise, the results will be inconclusive. Similarly, here, if we're using our mind as the tool of investigation to investigate the mind or to investigate the laptop or the person or whatever we're investigating, if that equipment is not functioning well, the results will be inconclusive. And generally now, the equipment of our mind is not functioning very well, unfortunately. We're caught up in a lot of obsessive compulsive thinking, easily distracted, half asleep. Our attention skills are generally not very good. So if our attention skills are not very good, this investigation process won't work very well at all. It'd be like using faulty equipment. So therefore, we need to get our equipment functioning well. So to get our equipment of the mind to function well is one of the core practices in Buddhism, often referred to as shamatha practice, or developing our attention skills. Developing the ability to have a calm, clear, and focused mind. That's the tool we need in this investigation. And this investigation, of course, in Buddhism is often called vipassana practice or insight practice. So the basis of our vipassana or insight practice is shamatha, is a calm, clear, focused mind. If we don't have that, this won't work very well. So therefore, if we really want to do this sort of investigation into reality, we need to work on developing a very calm and clear and focused mind. Then, with functioning equipment, we can do this investigation well and really come up with some conclusive answers and experiences. So that's the one point I wanted to mention. So maybe now if there's any questions about this practice or anything I've said so far, you can ask away.
Meditation session.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a point where I could feel that I could not feel the entire body.
The body, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Only like the breath, like when you were asking to concentrate on the breath.
Yeah.
So I lost my arms and everything.
Very good.
So, but could this really mean this is some sport? Some sort of spiritual, this could be also biological. Yes, I mean, whole of our body, most of the time it is controlled subconsciously. You might have also read. The conscious mind is only a...
Well, I think a lot of the processes in the body are not controlled.
They are controlled automatically, right? Like inside robots, okay? So robots do not have any consciousness. So humans also, when they have consciousness, it is only, you can say, 1%. Of the entire part. So everything what all the effects of meditation, could these be also biological or spiritual? Spirituality is just a term created. Like we think there is spirituality, so there is. Like you said, we see the world, so there is. So who can prove it? Where is the judge?
Mm.
Who can say what is right, what is wrong?
Mm. So the whole purpose of this is not just so that we can say, I know reality, you don't. I mean, the Buddha was not a philosopher. He was a doctor. The whole purpose of all of this is to overcome our suffering, to overcome our mental afflictions like craving, aversion, jealousy, and so forth, and all of our physical and mental suffering. So, and the Buddha said that to achieve that, the reason we're stuck in this situation is because we have a distorted view of reality, and this is what he discovered. This is a reality. He didn't intellectually make it up. This is coming from his direct experience. And so he said, you know, this is what I discovered. Don't believe it just because I told you. You have to check it out. But so our job is to check it out. And the test, of course, is whether or not it's valid, is our mental afflictions and suffering reducing or not? If it's not, then maybe it's not valid. Maybe he just sort of made up something. So this is really the test here is by doing this practice and coming to realize nature of reality, is our mental afflictions and suffering decreasing or not? If it's not, then maybe this is just some illusory idea and it's not helpful. So this, I think, is really the check, the test of whether or not this is the case. Because, again, there are many interesting philosophies in the world, and many of them are very smart and very intelligently conceived. But unfortunately, for many of them, either we have to accept or reject. There's no way of validating or testing them. The Buddha said, this is my theory, and this is how you test it empirically through doing this sort of practice. Unless we do this, it's just another theory, which may or may not be correct, may or may not be useful. And if we just leave it as a theory, then okay, it may sound nice and it may appeal to us and we think, yeah, that sounds good, I like that idea. And then, of course, it's not helpful. So, again, here in Buddhism at least, when we have all these theories of reality and mind and so forth, there is a method empirically to test and validate that. But it's up to us to be the good scientists to do that work. And, of course, like in science, we can do peer review. You know, the peer review process, of course, because there are many people who've done this investigation over centuries, and we can draw on their experience and receive peer review. And this is something very important in this investigation because we're using the mind to investigate, and there are so many places where we can go astray and make up all sorts of fabrications. So just like a good scientist, we need the peer review process and other people who've done the work to go, no, 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 this is where you've gone astray. You've really misinterpreted this, or you're not doing the practice properly. Like, you know, like recently the someone in CERN thought they found something that went faster than the speed of light. Remember that? And then a peer review eventually said, no, no, this is where you went wrong in your calculations or experimentation. So that was proven invalid. So likewise here for us is, we need to have the functioning equipment, we need to do the investigation, and we need the peer review process to make sure that we're on track and that we're not sort of making up some wild ideas based on our own experiences. So this is very important. And the bottom line is our mental afflictions and suffering reducing or not? If it's not, then maybe it's just some crazy idea that the Buddha made up.
Yeah, so my doubt is, when you talked about, when you gave an example of a pen and the laptop in the beginning, you said, if you talk in terms of non-existence, so I might be a little bit confused, but is non-existent mean it's not labeled? Because everyone labels it.
But again, you're saying it.
Yeah, because I'm not labeling it.
But you're saying, you're using the word it. So you've already created it. If you say it, it already exists, whether or not you've given a name. No?
We can see it. So it exists.
So there's one object here?
Yeah. I mean,
there's one thing here? From its own side. So you're saying labeling it. You're saying there's an it already there that we come along and label. But is there one thing there from its own side, independent of our conceptual framework?
Collection of atoms.
Oh, so it's more than one thing. So it's not it we're labeling, it's a collection we're labeling, actually.
Yeah, but physically it exists, isn't it?
It. But again, you say the word it. Yeah, I mean, this is what we do. That's what we instinctively do. It. It's there. No? Just like, it's there. Is there an it? Is there one thing there before, outside of our conceptual framework? Is there? No. So how is there an it there outside of our conceptual framework?
Yeah,
So you can't say label it. If you say it, you've already created an object. It's already existing within our conceptual framework. If you say it, it. No? So this is the real thing is when people ask this question, they say, oh, but if I go out the door, it will still be there, won't it? The real question here is, who's going out the door? Because whenever people ask this question, same with the idea of the tree falling in the forest, no one's there to watch it or hear it, what happened? The real question is, the real problem here is when people ask this question, they say, well, but when I go out the door, it will still be there. The question is, who's the I going out the door? Because we always have the assumption there's an independent me going out the door. So if we believe that the world exists and we believe there's an independent me, then by default, there must be an independent world. So the answer would be, yes, the laptop exists when I go out the door, if there is an independent me. Correct. The question is there an independent me going out the door? So again, as at the beginning I said, when we look around the world, it's just a mass of data, and we have to draw these lines and create objects. We do that to make sense of all of this. And how we draw the lines will depend on the context and the meaning we want to create. And most often we would create one object here, but some other times we may create two, whatever. And we have to do that. If we don't draw the line and give the name, then there'd be no meaning. We couldn't function. The problem is we don't realise that's what we're doing. We believe that it is there already prior to the conceptual framework. And we've turned the line that we draw here, we turn it into a boundary. There's already a separate discrete. There's it is there already. But in our experience, generally the very first line we draw is we draw a line around here and we create me. Because there's single experience, isn't there? Singular experience. And in singular experience, there are two aspects. Experiencer, experienced. And we need to conceptually identify those two aspects. Otherwise, we couldn't make any sense. And I think a newborn baby can't do that. They have to learn to do that, to conceptually create themselves as distinct from the world of experience. Otherwise, you can't function. We have to do that. But again, we don't realize that's what we're doing. We believe there's already a me here, independent of the world of experience. And there's the problem. And this is called self-grasping, grasping onto independent me. And from a Buddhist perspective, this is the root of all of our problems, this false view. And this idea there's an independent me is completely illogical. And to really highlight that, I can ask the question, is this big? Is it big?
Unless you compare it with something.
So you can't have big on its own, yeah? You can't have big and small. You can only have big relative to small, correct? You can't have big and small. It just doesn't make any sense. Like that, you can only have up with down, in with out. Like that, you can only have me relative to not me, or subject, object, experiencer, experienced. You can't have me on its own. It's just illogical. That's just like saying this is big. But that's how we see ourselves. We see ourselves as an independent me. But again, if we think about it a little bit, it's completely nonsense. It's completely illogical. It's like the way we see ourselves is like saying this is big. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. We can only have me relative to not me, the experiencer relative to experience. Therefore, me also exists within a conceptual framework. That's how we exist, as a dependent me. If we can understand that, not just intellectually, experientially, From a Buddhist perspective, we would never have any mental afflictions or suffering.
I'm not so sure whether the question is relevant or whether I'm asking the right question.
Sure.
But you say that the reality exists in a conceptual framework within the conceptual framework. My question to you is, how does this fall in line with quantum physics, which more or less says that whether the laptop is here or whether the laptop is halfway across the world, we don't know. Till a consciousness asks the question, it's only then the laptop appears here. Otherwise, the laptop could easily be in Australia.
So, therefore, according to quantum physics, so, laptop only exists relative to observer.
Yeah, so my specific question to you is that these two views are pretty much...
Well, first, and I don't claim to know anything much about quantum physics, but definitely it seems like there are a number of different interpretations. And certainly one group of physicists' interpretation of quantum physics, their interpretation is very close to this Buddhist view. I think there are other interpretations of quantum physics which differ, that they would be more a sort of physicalist, materialist interpretation. So I think one interpretation is, you know, we talk about this sort of superimposition state and this wave function collapse. And so I think this interpretation is saying this only exists within the mind of the observer, not as some separate thing that then collapses when there's an observer. But I really don't know much about quantum physics. But this is what this Donald Hoffman I mentioned before is. This is his sort of view now. Is he also tried to show other views in terms of that the matter was primary, the brain was primary, and the mind was somehow like a coming out of the brain, and he couldn't really make sense of any theories with that. And now his working hypothesis is actually the consciousness is primary. And so now he's developed a mathematical representation basis of the mind to represent the mind, and from that he's now trying to show how quantum physics, quantum mechanics can come out of that. So that's what he's doing at the moment. Very interesting research.
Two quick questions. You use the term dualistic mind. Can you
expand that? Yeah. Dualistic mind, of course, is the mind which thinks there's me here, an independent world, there's subject-object duality. And so this view of emptiness is saying there is no duality.
And you use clear with mind.
Sure.
Which is...
clear or clarity, sometimes clarity.
Which sounds like an oxymoron, because mind is always...
no. So again, we're talking about the entity of the mind. An analogy we can use here is glass. Glass is clear by nature. But often it can have a lot of dirt on it, can't it? Saying the mind is clear by nature, but often it has a lot of dirt on it. And so this is one analogy that you find in Buddhism because there are some, of course, modern theories which say that part of the inherent nature of the mind is anger, jealousy, craving. That's it. You're stuck with it. And there are many modern theories which say that. But the Buddhist theory says no, that all these mental afflictions like anger, jealousy, craving, very strong and habitual, but they're not part of the nature of the mind. Just like dirt is not part of the nature of glass. It's covering, and therefore what we see is dirt. We don't see the clear nature of the glass window until we clean the dirt. Similarly, for us now, our mind doesn't look very clear. It's full of dirt, full of mental afflictions. But we can remove these mental afflictions by doing this, then we will see this directly, just like we'll see the clear nature of glass if we remove the dirt. So that's often the analogy used.
So I want to know your answer for the question you asked, that what is the physical location of
it? Based on this, there is no physical location because the mind is not a physical phenomenon. So it has no spatial properties. Of course, generally, when we go, where's the mind? We say it's in here. Why? Because our belief system is based on generally on scientific materialism that the mind is an emergent property of the brain. And definitely we can empirically show that the brain is here. We know that. So therefore, based on our belief system, because the brain is here, we go, and the mind is a property of the brain, therefore the mind must be here. This is the materialistic, scientific materialistic view, of course. But here we're saying that the mind is not physical. According to Buddhism, it's not matter, it's not energy, it's not physical. So because it's not physical, it has no spatial qualities at all. No location, no size, and so forth. And that's what we were trying to do a little bit in this meditation, is in our direct observation, can we see any physical properties of mind? You know, because if the mind is like a property of the brain, then... and it's physical, then we should be able to see some sort of physical properties if we look at that object. But I think if we look in our direct experience of the mind, you will never see any physical properties. You will never see a colour or a shape or location for the mind. And that's what we were trying to do a little bit in that meditation.
So why is it the case?
Wait, there's one more at the back. I'll come.
Coming back to your same example of pen and laptop, how would you explain that same very true something which is shaped as like air, water?
Yeah, again, that's a concept. I mean, even time is a concept, isn't it, that we've developed to make sense of this flow. So likewise, all of these things are concepts. I mean, Higgs boson, isn't that a concept that I think Higgs himself developed to explain why things have mass? No? It's a concept. And then, of course, they have some data that seems to suggest or validate that concept, but it's just a concept. An atom is a concept, you know. A quark is a concept. Time is a concept. These are all concepts that we develop to make sense out of everything. And we have to make these concepts, otherwise we can't function. But the problem is we don't realise they're concepts. We turn the concept, and this is something I really like a lot, this idea. There's a term in psychology... called cognitive fusion. And fusion, of course, means sticking two things together, making them one, and cognitively to mentally do that. And we do this in so many different places, and it always creates problems. And here, cognitive fusion is we have the basis. So the basis is collection of atoms changing moment by moment. No problem, okay? Then we have the label, pen, and we are applying the label to the basis. Is the label the basis? No, it can't be. It can't be the basis if you're applying it to the basis by default. So the label is not the basis. This is not a pen. Pen is something we're labelling on the basis. But we do this cognitive fusion, we fuse the label to the basis, and we say, this is a pen. Then we're in trouble, because then we feel that there's a single thing there existing independent of our conceptual framework. So if we appreciate pen is merely something we're labelling on that basis, then there's no problem. But what we do is this cognitive fusion, we are fusing the label to the basis, making them one thing, when they're not. You have a basis of designation and you have the designated object. They can't be the same thing. And if we appreciate that, we'll understand this and there won't be any problems.
You mentioned that mind cannot understand the nature of mind.
It can. It does. I mean, that's what we're using to understand the nature of the mind.
Because you think that we have to be at a level higher.
No, what I said was... that the dualistic mind can never figure out the nature of reality. Because the nature of reality, emptiness, that experience is a realization there's no subject-object duality. So that experience of emptiness is a completely non-dualistic experience. And our mind is dualistic. So we can never know emptiness directly with our dualistic mind. It's impossible. Because it's our dualistic mind that is the problem. it's our dualistic mind that thinks there's a me here, an independent world. That's the problem. So like Einstein said, you can't solve a problem at the level you created it at. So we have to go beyond the conceptual dualistic mind to realize emptiness. This is a non-dualistic experience. So as I said before, if we come to realize this in meditation directly, and we come out of that and someone says, what did you realize? Please explain to me emptiness. You'll go, you won't have words because it's an experience beyond dualities, beyond conception. It's a non-dualistic experience. You can't use dualistic conceptual language to directly describe this. You can use similes and analogies and things to point people towards it, but then we have to come to realize it ourselves directly.
So what you're saying is that if you focus the mind, then you can actually go from a dualistic mind to a non-dualistic mind.
Yeah. Focusing the mind is just creating the equipment, the tool. So the shamatha practice or the concentration practice is just making functioning equipment. That's it. It's just like the scientists make sure that their equipment is working 100% correctly. That's shamatha practice. Then we use that equipment, the shamatha, the very clear, sharp mind, to penetrate the nature valley, to do this sort of investigation, to come to see and realize directly there's no findable me, there's no findable laptop and pen, and that not finding, I rubbed it out, the not finding experience in meditation is an experience of emptiness. And we hold that experience as long as we can. And if we do that well and at a deep enough level, that experience is a completely non-dualistic experience. In the experience, in the middle of that experience, there's no sense of me, the meditator, experiencing this emptiness. There's just the experience. It's only when you come out of it that you go, oh, I had a direct realization of emptiness just there. If we're having an experience and we're going, in the middle of the experience, we go, I'm directly realizing emptiness, 100% proof you're not. 100% proof. It's impossible to have thought at that time. You can't, if it's a valid experience. I think we're running out of time, is that right? No. Oh, okay.
Yeah. How long did it take for you to have your first experience of
Yes, I was supposed to this evening give a little bit of my sort of own experiences in this. So maybe I can mention a couple of things. First is mainly my experience has been where I've gone wrong and understood that and corrected myself. First, of course, when I first came to this, I thought this was a great idea, and I was very intellectual. My background was IT, so I wanted to figure it out. So I spent a lot of time and effort trying to figure it out, and I got some sort of vague idea of this, but then it's like sort of, you know, you're trying to grab something that's not grabbable, and then you just get frustrated. And then, so that first happened. So I let go of that. And then, of course, I thought, well, okay, then I need to really sort of try and meditate on this. So I tried to do some Vipassana insight practice. And, of course, it wasn't working very well because I didn't have this shamatha. I didn't have working equipment, you know, because all Buddhist traditions, one of the core practices is this shamatha practice, to develop functioning equipment, to develop a calm, clear, focused mind. All Buddhist traditions say this is one of the three core practices. But if you go and look at all the Buddhist traditions in the world today, what they're actually practicing, it seems to get left out. Because a lot of traditions talk about Vipassana. In the Tibetan Buddhism, they talk a lot about this emptiness. They talk about bodhicitta. They talk about all sorts of practices. But where is this shamatha practice that makes the mind functional so we can do all of these practices? It seems to get left out. And so I also left it out, largely. And so I was doing these practices and not really getting anywhere. And then I thought, and this is particularly when I came into contact with Alan Wallace, who really emphasizes this so much, and now I do a lot as well, because it's the basis of this. If we don't do this practice, we can do a lot and not get anywhere. It's like a scientist running an experiment again and again and again and again with faulty equipment. I mean, you're never going to get a decisive answer with faulty equipment. So fix the equipment, make it functional. So that's what I learned. So I put now a lot more effort into the shamatha practice, and now, of course, the other practices are starting to work a bit better. And one more thing I'd like to add is with this, particularly this emptiness sort of practice, you go through stages. And here I like to use the Tibetan words because they're very short.
It took you something like 5 to 10 years to get this?
This goal is intellectual, nyam is experience, tok is realization. So if we want the Vipassana practice to get to the level of realization, which is a stable experience, we need a very calm, focused mind, this mind of shamatha. And how much effort do we need to put in to get this? There are various different assertions in the original meditation texts, but Alan Wallace, who does a lot of this practice, he was suggesting that modern studies show that in any technical area of expertise, whether it's a physical or music or any technical area of expertise, if you want to become expert in that technical field, you need minimum 5,000 hours of practice across the board, any field. If you want to become a master at it, you need 10,000 hours of practice in any field. So he's suggesting maybe it's the same amount of effort we need here. That's his idea. Why not? In every other field, it seems consistent. 5 to 10,000 hours is needed if you want to become proficient. Why not here? That's his idea. So I've still got quite a lot of work to do. But what I do find is that the shamatha practice, the more and more you practice it, not only will you have direct benefit because your mind will become more calm, less stressed, more focused, more effective in everything we do in our life, much less mental afflictions, you have all of these direct benefits and generally a lot of physical health benefits, because a lot of our physical illnesses in our modern society are suppressed mental content, and we can release that. So often people who do this practice well have a lot of improvement in physical health as well. So there are a lot of immediate benefits from the shamatha practice, but then on that basis you can really go deeper into this practice. So that's what I'm sort of trying to do now. I don't know if we're running out of time, maybe.
So this emptiness is the final stage, or what after emptiness?
Yeah. So, of course, now if we meditate on this emptiness, we can have a nyam, which is called a taste. And sometimes people have this sort of spontaneously without meditating. You know, often this can happen if we go out into nature and we have a strong experience of nature. And then through that strong stimulus, this grasping onto me drops away sometimes. And so often people have this oneness experience with nature. This is a little taste of emptiness. And this can be very strong and have a strong, profound impact on the person. And then usually for a little few hours or day, they're much more calm, they're much less mental afflictions, they seem more connected with others, and then it wears off, and then they're back to the normal. Same with meditation here, is that we can have a little taste and then out of meditation we can feel more calm, more connected, less mental affliction, and it'll wear off. That's why we need the shamatha practice, the concentration practice, so that this taste can turn into a realization. Then, if we realize emptiness directly, we can really start to wipe out mental afflictions. But one realization of emptiness is not enough. We have to keep doing that again and again. And then eventually over time, the Buddhist assertion is we can overcome all mental afflictions, we can clean the dirt off the mind, and then the mind will be completely clear and pure, and then we've achieved liberation, we've achieved what's called nirvana, this goal of liberation from suffering. That's the Buddhist assertion. But that would require a number of many direct realizations of emptiness to do that. So this is the practice to get that goal.
The mind is not material.
No, not the Buddhist assertion, no.
So what is the relation of connection to the body and mind?
Again, a little bit like this Donald Hoffman saying, is that we, in the scientific materialistic view, particle or matter is primary and sort of mind is like a sort of a property of that or a function of that. Whereas There are some that talk about, you know, like Descartes' famous dualistic idea of mind-body. And so this is often the hard problem. How's the mind-body thing working? If we have this dualistic idea of mind and body or material world as being two separate things. Whereas, like Donald Hoffman is saying, and this is the Buddhist view, it's a monistic view, is that consciousness is primary and the material world comes out of that. This is a very radical, different approach. But this is what Donald Hoffman's coming to now after many years of his own research. And this is the sort of the Buddhist view, that consciousness is primary. It's not like this, you know, how do these two things work together? It's consciousness is primary and the material world comes out of that. That's sort of the Buddhist assertion.
Sir, I don't know whether it was my illusion or what it was. Like during meditation, when I was feeling my breath, I was hearing some sound, minute sound. What it was, like right now I'm talking to you, I can't hear that sound.
Yeah, what you find, and in meditation, of course, you have many different experiences. And the thing is, if we meditate, if we really relax the body and we calm the mind, we start to notice a lot of things that we've never noticed before. I mean, now there's sensations going on in the body all the time, isn't there? Do we notice them? If it's strong pain, yes. But we don't notice these sensations. But if we sit down quietly and we just observe here, for instance, suddenly we notice all these subtle sensations there. Did they magically appear now and they weren't there before? No. Same with you. A lot of things, you know, you can like even hear the heartbeat in your ear. You can feel, you can have these subtle sounds in the ear. These are just things we notice now because our mind is more calm and clear. That's all. It's nothing mystical. It's fine. Maybe last question and then we need to maybe finish, I think. Yeah.
You have explained, as I understood, there were two parts of the presentation. One was existence and non-existence and a middle path in between.
The two extremes, yes.
Yeah. And that is what you were giving a lot of analogies, which all seem to be right,
mm-hmm.
but still I fail to understand the relation between those analogies. That is one part. But the second part is, that what is the relation of that with the meditation? Because meditation, how you said, that is very easy. We can do it, we can concentrate, we can look at all the sensations in our body, and definitely the result is positive. I have seen that you calm down and the anger and all those qualities reduce substantially. That is one part, very easy to understand. But the first part, which you spend all the time on,
sure.
What is the relation between them?
Right. Well, the meditation you were describing was mainly this shamatha practice, which is just to develop a calm, clear mind, which is, from to use the analogy of a scientist, that is simply making the equipment functional. So that, so far, the scientist hasn't proven anything. They haven't run any experiments yet. All they've done is they've made sure that their equipment is now completely operational. So that's the shamatha practice, just to calm the mind and focus the mind. And that has immediate benefits in our life. So that's not what I was talking about here. That's the basis. Because what we're talking about here is the vipassana practice, the emptiness practice, which is using that functional equipment to run the experiment. So what's the experiment we're doing here is in the meditation is we were looking at how does the mind exist? You know, can we, is it has any physical properties? Can we find the mind? Is it located somewhere? That's the experiment we were running. So that's what I was talking about here, is running the experiment with functional equipment to work out, to come to see the nature of reality. And here, this middle way between the two extremes is to overcome the extreme of existence, to come to experientially see that nothing exists independently. That's one extreme. And the other extreme is that nothing exists. And the middle way is emptiness and dependent arising, that things exist, but only within the conceptual framework. That, to use the other analogy, is that there's no big and small. So that's this realization. But big and small exist, don't they? But they only exist relative, dependently. There is big and small, so it's not nihilism, but there's no big and small. So that's the two extremes. The two extremes is big and big doesn't exist. But there is big and small. The middle way is realizing that, that big and small exist, but only dependently, not independently. That's what we're doing in this investigation.
So when we feel oneness, that is that middle way.
When you're investigating, let's say if you're investigating the mind or the body or the person, and you come to see it's not findable, it doesn't exist independently, that not finding is an emptiness experience. The not finding is the emptiness experience. We hold that as long as we can to allow it to penetrate deeper into the mind. And the flip side of that is the realization, therefore, everything's interdependent. Because there's no independent big, therefore big exists dependently. So that's the flip side of emptiness. So they have the synonymous, but the experience in meditation is simply the not finding. And then in daily life, the flip side is that we see that everything's interdependent. It's the same meaning. They're like two sides of a coin. Takes a bit of time. Okay, I think we've run out of time there. So I'd just like to finish by thanking the people responsible for putting on this event this evening. I'm very happy to come along here, and hopefully I can come again sometime in my future travels through India. And if anyone wants to listen to any more talks or courses that I lead, I've got my own website. There's a lot of materials and audio on there. Also, my schedule's on there. And then in the next time, as Malay said, I'll be leading a couple of retreats in Bangalore in January. And then I'm hoping to... I've just come from Tishita Meditation Center in Dharamsala. I just spent the last 2 months there running courses and retreats. And I'm planning to be again in the autumn, October, November next year up there. So if you want to come up for a 10-day course, time well spent. So... might see you up there next year then. So thank you very much.